that make sense?
Okay, great. Great, thank you. All right, so AMAT's Citizen Involvement Committee meeting for January 20th. Thank you for attending. Start with introductions. I'm Curtis Baker. I'm the director of AMATS. Heather, you want to
I'm Heather Davis Riddle. I am also with AMATS.
Kate Clark, observer. I'm the big women voters admin area.
Bill Mackey, CIC long term member.
Farhad Ahmad Zaid, working with AMATS.
Daryl Kleinhans, planner with AMATS.
Jeff Gardner, AMATS staff. So we thank you guys for attending. I know it's not always the top of the list of things you want to do on a Thursday night, so we appreciate your willing to take the time with us. For our Citizen Involvement Committee meeting today, really wanted to discuss two things. The first is our projects that we will be funding with federal funding that AMATS gets allocated through the transportation authorization. As you might know, the bipartisan infrastructure legislation, which is commonly called the BIF, was passed late last year, which included new programmatic funding for agencies like ours, Metropolitan Planning Organizations. But even before that happened, AMATS was going through a round of funding to use its Surface Transportation Block Grant Program, its resurfacing program, and its transportation alternative set-aside. So STBG is a program that can be really used for any type of funding that regards to roads. So we can fund reconstructing pavement, roundabouts, widenings, anything. The money is very flexible. The resurfacing program is specifically just for pure, they call it mill and fill resurfacing. They take a layer of asphalt off and they put asphalt back on. And then we have our transportation alternatives program, which is really our bicycle and pedestrian recommendation. So we want to talk a little bit about that. An important thing to note was this was the first time we've started our PDIP process, which is the Project Delivery Incentive Program. One of the things we found at AMATS was that sometimes we would award funding to communities for projects, and those projects would sit for a long time. It would take a long time for the project design to happen, and then the right-of-way acquisition, and finally construction. And we felt like we needed to incentivize our local communities to making sure that they get these projects done on time. Because of that, we started the PDIP process, or the PDIP program, which helps communities by offering them a 10% reduction of their local share for a federal aid project like ours. So if a project is done, a resurfacing project is ready to go, the plans are ready, and it's ready to be bid for construction in 2 years from when, from basically these January dates that we're approving them, those projects will receive 90% federal funding instead of 80% federal funding. This is something that's used, we're using a fairly archaic element of transportation, Ohio transportation law, which is called toll revenue credits that allow us to do this through our the turnpike. But the whole point of the program is really just to enable projects to move faster, because we feel as though local communities sometimes they get our money and yet then they kind of stall out. And we want to kind of keep fighting, and we're hoping that 10% additional is going to push them forward. We received 64 applications, $75 million in requests. We had roughly about $28 million to allocate, and in fairness, that $28 million is always a moving target because our projects that are already in the pipeline, every time another stage of design happens, the cost changes the project. We ended up recommending 37 projects totaling $40 million, and most of the projects will be allocated in fiscal year 2024, 25, and 26. And just for those of you that aren't familiar, fiscal year is the ODOT fiscal year, which begins on July 1st. So this coming July will be the beginning of 2023. Next July would be 2024. And we have the ability to move projects around. As I said, the STBG is our most versatile. We can use it for right-of-way purchases as well as construction. We received 16 applications for $47.8 million, and we selected seven projects. The seven projects are listed here. Stowe and Darrow Road, Akron, Cuyahoga Falls, Streetsboro, Macedonia, Hudson, and Green. All these projects scored well enough to receive funding, and we're pretty excited about a lot of them. We think that they'll be pretty beneficial to the region. Going on to resurfacing, which we only fund construction for, we received 31 applications for about $19 million and selected 24 projects. So an interesting thing here is that we limited the number of awards per community to 2 awards per community. And what that really allowed us to do is fund a whole lot of different communities resurfacing projects that may not have gotten funded if we had just funded kind of straight line down the list. Here's the first 12 of the projects. As you can see, most of the amount was capped at $700,000 with the PDIP program. They would be eligible for up to $787,500. As you can see, we have a lot of different variation of where these projects are going. Pretty much everyone that applied for a resurfacing project received at least one. And so we're really happy to see that diversity in our program and excited for these projects. And especially these projects are usually ones that can happen very quickly. So that's very good for us in managing our program. Finally, the transportation alternatives, which, like I said, is bicycle and pedestrians projects. This can fund engineering, right-of-way construction, 15 applications. And we selected 6 projects for a total of a little more than $4 million. These projects are always hotly contested and very interesting as we try to build a trail network that can connect into our spine trails, which we see as the bike and hike in Summit Metro Park's bike and hike, the Towpath Trail, Headwaters Trail in Portage County, as well as the Portage in Portage County. Trails that we were able to fund, Rubber City Heritage Trail through Akron, which is a exciting urban trail that we've been trying to build, which is an old trolley line that Akron actually owns the right-of-way to. Kent, as part of their East Main Street roundabout upgrades, is putting in a trail that's going to help connect the Portage, extend the Portage further to the east. Wayne County, this is the first time now that they're members, they were able to apply and were able to build a part of the Heartland Trail in Wayne County, which is pretty exciting. Hudson, looking at the old rail line that runs from Akron to Cleveland through Hudson. This piece in Hudson is one of the pieces of the abandoned rail line that there's still a potential for building a trail on. We have a Springside Sidewalk project in Summit County. That's where we had built in Montrose. We built Bath Township Sidewalk on the north side of Montrose. Now we're going to take, and we've also funded on Cleveland Maslin going north. Now we're funding Springside, so we're actually going to have the full loop around that area and the hotels that are there, so we're excited about that. And in Stowe, the Darrow Road sidewalks up and down 91, where we started building some, but we're going to have more in the future. This just kind of shows by project type the funds that are available. You know, $4 million in bike and pedestrian, about $24 million, 61% really focused on maintenance and preservation. $9 million is operational improvements. That's not true capacity adding. That's operational from the standpoint of, say, turn lanes, things that just help traffic flow a little bit better. And then our green project is adding some capacity and lane width to that. So this is kind of the list. This is the list of projects we're asking. This is not really for CIC. It's important for the program managers to get this stuff programmed. But I think what we're seeing this time is we're awarding about $40 million of projects in the greater Akron. We're trying to set up our program so that one of the items that the BIF created was there's a lot of federal, national grants that are available. Part of over-programming and providing more funding for our projects is to set them up to potentially go after some of these federal grants. So if they can say, hey, we've got some AMAX funding, and we can go to the feds and ask for another 50% of that amount, We think it positions them better than other MPOs and other areas that are applying for these funds. So, with that, that's the short version. But I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm sure Bill has some.
Why pick on me? We have another guest here. Yeah. That's the best first.
Hey, you just got the target on your back. But yeah, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Since you asked,
yeah.
Looking at other agencies, other systems, and they are crying, we're going to have a material shortage, or the material cost is going to be very high.
Yes.
Has this been added into this program?
Most of our communities, when they come to us with estimates, are trying to factor in an inflation element to their requests. The bottom line is that I don't think anyone's predicting, you know, say 10 to 15%. So if we did get 10 or 15%, we could be, you know, there could be more local responsibility for those projects. I think the hope is that we've peaked when it comes to inflation, and by peaked I mean just not going too much higher than where we are now. But really, it is an unknown, and it is a risk to not, you know, the federal funds that we award to these communities are going to stay the same. The question is will they be able to find the additional local funds if those inflationary pressures continue? I think a lot of communities, they've asked for as much as they feel comfortable that they can, or they've come to ask for our limit. But I think they all know, and they all pass legislation saying that, hey, any costs above and beyond will be borne by the local community. So I guess that's not really as much of a good answer, but it's sort of the expectation is that the locals will carry that burden.
All right. Because cost of living is one thing when you see depleted shelves in a grocery store somewhere else versus not everybody walks out and orders 100 tons of asphalt.
Right.
Right. And of course, there's a labor shortage there too. Will the companies that want to do this have enough people available
right.
to do the project
yeah.
in a timely manner?
Yeah. And it's been interesting. I mean, like, all we can talk about is anecdotally from, you know, when communities have gone out to bid for projects, we're starting to hear that they're coming back higher, you know, than they were estimated at. And I think that's been anticipated. The question is how high does that go? I mean, I think I remember in like 07, 06, it was pretty high. And, you know, we were going way above what the estimates were. And then obviously the recession hit and we were way under again. And then we start going back to, you know, sort of a flat line for a while. But I think most communities are trying to bake that in. But again, if it swings dramatically, that's something that it could potentially be a problem. It could be where communities are asking us for more aid, or they're going back to their constituents and explaining why they need another $200,000. Mm-hmm. I mean, I will say personally, like, I'm really pleased with this slate of projects. Like, I think we got a really nice swath of projects. I think we're you know, a lot of communities are getting work in their areas, and that, you know, what we're hoping is that we'll start to see the benefit of this kind of investment in things like our pavement condition index, where we rate our roads to say what's the quality. You know, we're hoping that this amount of funding, you know, $14 million in resurfacing, it's going to be one of those things where we start seeing those metrics start to increase. You know, we can say, hey, our region's pavement is getting better. Because as of right now, we've been pretty stagnant at our levels of pavement. So, you know, we're optimistic that this will be a positive. Any other questions on that?
Can you talk about the over-programming at all?
Yeah, so I'm going to touch on this a little bit. I don't remember, but one of the things that is so important from our perspective is that when you have money that's like federal money or state money, you always have to prove that you have a need for that money. And the worst thing that we can do as an MPO, as a Metropolitan Planning Organization, is end the year with money in our bank account. Because, I mean, even though that's not how we balance our checkbooks, but the idea is like, well, hey, if you have $250,000 in your budget, that must mean you don't have a project that needs the funding. And so because of that, we are very aggressive. I think in the numbers that I showed you, you know, we're committing to $40 million when we think our allocation is only $28 million. What that does is, what happens is, because we do have projects that are so complicated that they tend to slip. So we might award, you know, Kenny's Main Street's a great example, and they're on time right now, but it's going to be almost a $20 million project with multiple funding sources. Right now they're in 2025, but if something happens in the right-of-way, all of a sudden they're going to slip to 2026. Well, that's $5 million of our funding that just all of a sudden we have a positive balance now in that year. And so we've got to pull in other projects to get them to be ready, so that if a project slips, we don't end up showing a positive balance at the end of the year. And so that's what we do when we're over-programming, is that, you know, in a weird way, it's not the way anyone would balance a checkbook, but it is the best way to make sure that we have projects in the pipeline that we can fill in and backfill when we do see projects slipping out in, you know, from 2025, now they're in 2027. So that's really the purpose of why we do that. And, you know, but I could see that if you were an accountant, you would probably have like heart palpitations of, you know, basically allocating 40% more funds than you actually have. But in our experience too, larger projects tend to take about 7 years to be developed. Smaller projects can take up to 2. So when we award a lot of big projects, we know we need a lot of small projects behind them in case that slippage happens, because, you know, we'd all love to say that projects shouldn't take 7 years from funding to construction, but the reality is that sometimes they take even more than that. All right, so with that, I will move on to the next element, which we were going to discuss today, which is our public participation plan. We update our public participation plan every 4 years as part of our transportation planning process. So, you know, basically our process starts after we approve a long-range plan, then our process starts to develop the next long-range plan. As part of that process of transportation planning, we always first go back and look at our transportation, our public participation plan, because that's really what starts it off. It makes sure that we're on the right foot. It makes sure that we're prepared to engage with the public as we develop a 4-year planning process for transportation infrastructure. So for the 3P, this is a draft. This is the beginning of the comment period that starts today. You've got over 45 days where we'll be engaging stakeholders to get comments. You know, the biggest things, and Carrie mentioned this at the TAC, was that we wanted to make sure we incorporated recommendations that we received from Federal Highway and FTA, Federal Transit Administration, when we were last certified as an MPO. Some of their comments, I will admit, are a little bit bureaucratic in terms of what they wanted us to do, but some of the updates to our process include, you know, updating our Title VI complaint process, identifying how we respond to public comments, and then evaluating the effectiveness of our public engagement, which actually, that third one, I think, is really important. One of the things we're trying to do now with our public participation plan is to measure the engagement. So it's looking at how many website hits do we get, how many people respond to our Twitter feed, you know, what's the amount of likes we get on posts, how many press releases are we doing, how many workshops are we doing. All those types of metrics built into our public participation plan so that we can have an idea of the effectiveness of our engagement process. There's no question that since the pandemic, and even before that, public engagement's been changing. It's becoming harder and harder to get someone to show up to a 6:30 meeting, but it might be easier to get them to take 30 seconds on their smartphone to check if they like something or not. And that's one of the things we're trying to adapt to as part of this plan is, providing multiple different types of ways to engage with AMATS and engage in the process. I think the biggest challenge that we have is that most people will come out to a meeting if you say, hey, we're going to be doing a project in your front yard, and it's happening in 6 months. When you say, hey, we're doing long-range planning out to 2050, you know, people are like, oh, well, what, you know, is this going to happen? And you're like, well, it might not happen, but it's part of the plan. So it is hard to get engagement, and an engagement that we do get, it's hard to say, oh, well, that's the general opinion. It's not the necessarily just because three people come out and give us comments, it doesn't mean that that's the way that everyone feels. And so I think our biggest challenge moving forward with our public participation plan is, you know, trying these different layers of engagement to, you know, get the people that want to come to a meeting, get the people that want to go to Facebook, get the people that just want to click on a link and, you know, answer a two-question survey. But how do we get a sense of that we're going in the right direction through public engagement? And that's a constant challenge for us. We will be, like I said, sharing this document with all interested parties, trying to get some feedback on it. And I think our hope is that, you know, with this plan, it gives us a nice path, especially from a metric perspective, to just be able to measure how effective we are and be aware of it. So, hey, we had this many people show up to CIC. We had this many people part of this webinar. We had this many people part of this. And trying to find the right mix of activities that get the, you know, a level of engagement that we think is satisfactory. So, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So, I know there are Indian restaurants and Asian food grocers and Bhutanese groups.
Are you going to send me to a bunch of restaurants and get super fat?
Well, I'm going toward the idea. It's great to say we have the ability to tap to Twitter or Facebook. But new groups don't necessarily have smartphones. They're here, they're resettling, trying to find a job. Where they are going is the BMV. And where they are going is the International Institute of Accra, the language. So, in our scenario here, and I don't know where the incoming Afghans are going to settle, how that's going to be handled, that's a different group. But those might be target groups you could have a flyer in their language that would explain, you got to learn English, and here's what the transportation planning does in a financial sense. That might get their attention because they're worried about money.
So one of the things that we are doing is this year we're hoping to actually, Carrie is talking to me about setting up meetings with organizations that are involved in those types. So like
I'm thinking of the Cleveland Clinic. When you get a bill from them, they got 20 languages on a handout back of it. If you don't understand this bill, here's who to contact that speaks your language at this number. So
yeah,
that's
right.
And they got all these populations.
Right, and we're trying to engage more with the Bhutanese population. Right. Obviously, the Afghan population that, you know, hopefully we'll see more immigrants. I think, you know, that is a challenge, and it always has been. And I think again, even for those folks, you know, why do they care about 2050 when, like you said, you know, they're worried about today?
Yeah.
You know,
where do I live? Where do I get food? How do I drive? How do I get to a job? Yeah.
How do I find a job? You know, how do I get integrated? And, it's hard. I mean, it really is. And we've even reached out to agencies where you meet them and you talk to people. But in the end, you still can't get that much traction because they're saying, so what do you want us, you know, we're like, we just want you to know who we are. You know?
Right. Oh, and here's a free Summit County map.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, give them something.
Yeah.
They've got to learn how to get around. Maybe they don't have a something on her smartphone or me. I got a Garmin in the car type thing, so.
Yeah. So, I mean, but I think those are good comments. I mean,
you know. Make yourself known.
Right. I mean, make I hate to say known. It. It's hard enough to get a natural, you know, a natural born citizen to a public meeting, let alone an immigrant that's been
I'm not saying they're going to come to a meeting. I'm saying just make yourself known.
Right.
So they got a little short 25-word sentence that says, our job in the government is to do this.
Yeah.
You know. Of course, we did have somebody come in, an American citizen, and complain about their street, and it's not the right place, and he talked to their mayor, you know, not here.
I think, Bill, we could probably take that a step further and maybe collect other items, such as Metro information,
Metro,
maybe Summit County public health information as well, and sort of put a package together and then approach those entities in that way. I think that might be beneficial. If it's all together.
Yeah, we don't want them to run to the ER every time they feel sick. We want them to go to maybe a CVS or Walmart health center, whatever they call those, where you walk in and stuff, tell them you're sick.
Okay.
With a little package of, I'm sick, I have a temperature, I'm ill, whatever.
Yes.
That would help them get through talking to a medical person without having to them having to run around and find a translator.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of groups out there that, rather than hitting them separately, maybe with yours, maybe, you know, we can coordinate an effort to combine that into one package so they know what to do in each situation if it came up. Or at least have that knowledge on hand, all in one basket, folder.
Was
put together.
All right. Pretty good. I mean, I went through it. I like the new technology. I'm just worried about trying to reach the new minority groups that have always been a problem in America with immigrants, you know, trying to get on their feet.
Yeah, and I mean, I think we fully acknowledge that we don't have we don't have that perfect solution. I think what our goal is to just try different things to get a
feedback.
Level of engagement.
Yeah. I'll tell you what they're not interested in.
Right. Yeah. Those were the two main items tonight that we wanted to discuss. I can obviously then, you know, typically open it up to any concerns regarding regarding transportation planning in the region. But, you know, so really open the floor if anyone has any comments or concerns.
And just during the technical advisory committee, I don't know if you remember Kay, but someone had brought up that the maps that were in the 3P probably should be dated, you know, so the elderly population as well as the low income population should have a date on there.
Yeah,
so that was a
census data.
Thank you.
I was looking at some government entity today, and the map looks nice, but you know, it's only like postcard size on a screen. I mean, they could have expanded it, or they could eastern half, western half, so you could at least read the thing.
Right. Well, that's in a way with this thing. I think it's kind of funny because. This is just our draft. You know, this isn't the final layout, but it looks like it's a completed. I mean, it really has the look and feel of like a completed document. But you know, there's so much that I think could add. But it's sort of, you know, in a way, I hope it doesn't look almost too finished. Like, oh, we're done, and we don't care what you think. But it was just actually the easiest way to print it out was to bind it and do it that way. Because I do think there's definitely things that we're going to edit and change in this through the 45-day comment period.
Need to have a lady in there with her Arabian headdress on. This is public. It's not all white Americans now. Think about who you're trying to attract with that picture.
I know, we only have so many pictures of people at our CIC
meeting.
Yeah,
that's one of our own pictures.
Yeah, this is from one of our CIC meetings, or from one of our public meetings.
You need a guy in a sick headdress, you need a lady in her
diversity
outfit, public.
Did you distribute those by mail?
No, we just got them back this week, so we weren't able to include them in our mail out that we send out. I mean, we did include a PDF copy, but what we'll do now is we will start sending copies to agencies and others that, you know, are interested in reviewing. I mean, that is the other thing, too, is that it's so much more a digital age now that, you know, we don't necessarily always print out, say, 400 copies anymore to distribute because... it's just not the way people are getting their information. You know, we still have boxes. So we, you know, right about 2010, we were printing out, you know, 500 copies, and all of a sudden, nobody's taken one. And we've still got, you know, like boxes of reports from a decade ago, because it just, it quickly changed in the way that people wanted it. So we do have printed copies, obviously, but then it's online, and, you know, we're encouraging people to review it that way. And Bill, we've been on the CIC a lot. We've talked about this a lot, about different ways to find the right level of engagement. You know, get people interested. And it's just one of those things that, you know, I don't know. I think maybe I probably would be satisfied if 20 people showed up every 2 months to talk about long-range transportation issues. But, it, you know, I mean, we had some success when we specifically, when we had that, I think the last big successful meeting we had was when we talked about the Interbelt. And we had, you know, we had a councilman from Akron here, and we were just playing the role of, hey, we helped fund this project, we want to get feedback, you know. And sometimes I think, but that was very current at the time. You know, it was a very specific to, hey, we're watching this project happen, what are you going to do with the land, you know. Which, ironically, they still haven't figured out what they're going to do. But, you know, when we have meetings like that, I feel like we get more turnout. But the reality is, it's like what we're trying to get engagement on is, you know, what do we want things to look like in 20 years? Like, what are we worried about? What are we hopeful about? You know, do we like the types of projects we're funding? Are we funding the right type of projects? And unfortunately, I think it's just such a, I hate using the word bureaucratic, but it's such a government process that in itself, it sort of creates a shield around it, because it's complex enough that the average person, like, looks at one of these documents and is like, can you summarize it for me? You know, yeah. So it's a challenge. I mean, we've been dealing with that, I feel like, since I've been here, trying to get a higher level of turnout and more people interested.
Well, I don't know. Like you say, when you come and tell a person, hey, we're going to dig up your street, you're not going to have access to your driveway.
Right. And it's like, boom. It's like everybody's calling their councilman, and, you know. But, you know, and so it's there are ways we engage, like our Bike and Brainstorm program that Daryl puts on. I mean, it's a great way that we get people out on bikes and participating and getting feedback that way. You know, and so we've gone that route to get more, we've gotten feedback that way. But there's still elements that, like, you know, a lot of times we'll get people that are just, they're into biking, and that's what they do. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that's like a perfect swap of who's living in the region and getting feedback from kind of all sorts. And I mean, we still struggle with the African American community, you know, getting real feedback from especially like those neighborhoods, you know, Copley Road, south of Copley Road, Diagonal. You know, it's just, the story sticks in my head of the city of Akron did the road diet on Copley Road, so it was two lanes in each direction, and they did a road diet, and they kind of did it overnight. They just made the decision, we're going to go from four lanes to three lanes. And, you know, it had been like 4 years later after that had happened, and I was meeting with state rep, Emily Sykes, and we were talking about transit and stuff, and she's like, well, all I know is, like, that can never happen. I mean, she was very upset about the fact that that had happened in her community without anybody knowing, you know, without it being like this big public engagement.
Well, how does the average driver like myself know something's going to happen?
Right.
There's a message board pops up saying, we're going to close this road in 1 week for the following
and
6 months.
They didn't do anything.
You don't know. Don't know what's going on. Right. You're closing a road, and you don't know, you know, well, okay, now I better figure out how to get around.
Yeah. But, you know, it's just like there was such a lack of engagement, but that's always stuck with me of, like, you know, you need to get that. You can't make these decisions without it, because there was a lot of bitterness there. And, you know, and the way that the people in the community used those four lanes was different than in a way that I, you know, like, I had a guy say to me, well, you know, like, I used to pull into the right lane because I dropped my mother off at the barber or at the hair salon. And so that right lane was almost like a, you know, it was almost like a pull. And that was the way the neighborhood used those streets. But for us passers through, it was like, why is this person slowing down on the right lane? And, you know, and it's just, it's, for me, it was good to get that context and be reminded that.
Well, you're talking about bureaucracies, meaning the governments.
Right.
So in Cuyahoga Falls, we get a monthly billing statement. Well, I still do. You may get it on your computer. And I've asked the city, why don't you put a statement, because they got a lot of white space on these forms. Put a statement in there to let your community know what's happening, you know, when and what's going to, what's the impact of it. Oh, well, no, it costs extra printing costs. I don't know if it's extra printing costs now with all these email forms.
Right.
It sounds like a lame excuse right now. But if you're going to take care of your constituency, you need to tell them what's going on and not depend on the Beacon Journal or the Falls Press, which is a local weekly paper. If they're not going to carry it, it's not interesting, unless the government pays for that space.
Right.
There are different ways of attaching people, getting them to get emotionally attached to the project, other than we're going to dig a hole in your front yard. So.
Right.
Well, change your rules. If you want federal money, you got to put a notice in your local paper for a month ahead of time.
What's funny is that there are those rules already exist. It's just they're
to inform the constituencies.
Yeah, like they, you know, they're required as part of the environmental phase to do a public meeting, and you know, and so, but there's a very standard. You put it in the paper. I think it has to be in the classifieds, and this is like an ODOT policy. But you know, it's obvious now that that's not the way.
That's not the way people read.
Yeah, it's just not. But that's still the way things are done, and you know.
Well, as MPO, can you tell ODOT to change it? This MPO says we need to change it, so it goes on here.
But you know, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. It's like that's the way they do it, you know. And so it's you might have to ask 10 times before they consider really trying to change it.
I'll be back in 2023 and 2024 and ask this public participation thing about. Have we changed the rules to get the public informed? Be it by the water bill.
Right.
Everybody has water or gas bill. Some people have electric heat or gone solar or they're off the grid. But you still could reach a majority of the constituency.
Are you off the grid, Bill?
I've always been off the grid.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. That's a frustrating thing about working in government is that you can always say things can be better, because it's true. Like, we could always do a better job of notifying and, you know, and it's just there's so many layers to break through to get some things to happen.
Yeah.
It's a challenge.
Yeah. Are we going to open now? Or
yeah, we've been open, Bill.
Uh-oh. You get to read that.
It'll burn it.
You get to read that. You take that back to the So what they have is shipping containers, and they put railroad wheel trucks on the front and the back, and they put electric motor on it, and an autopilot, and send it down the rails. No train, no engineer, nothing. It's just automatic pilot, just like an airplane flying along on autopilot, but they're following the rails. So knowing this now, and the MPOs are worried about rail traffic, here comes a 2-3 engines hauling 100 cars, and the gates come down, and everybody waits, and the gates go up. But what if you had one of these every 5 seconds going through a crossing? Because they don't need to be hooked together. And they're not going to coordinate with the Cuyahoga Falls City or the Summit County. We're just going to send these on the rails, and we don't care that the gates go up and down every 5 seconds. What I'm saying is I see a conflict if they go to this. Now you can have it back. It's sort of like, and this is the next one. It's sort of like 1908, and you're in Dayton, and you hear this noise in the sky. Oh, that's some crazy Wright brothers. They got some sort of flying kite up there or something.
Was that a Kitty Hawk?
And it's not going to make any change. It's not going to make any change. I've still got my horses, and I'm plowing my field. Nothing's going to change because of that airplane. Well, things change rapidly because of a new technology. So there's a new technology. That can go that way. And this can go this way. And EVTOLs, electrical vertical takeoff landing transportation devices.
The Jetson one. Is there one called the Jetson?
Yeah, the Jetson's right. He had one. But we're talking single or multiple passenger electric vehicle that might fly 50 miles, take off from my home in Cuyahoga Falls and fly down to the Akron Canton Airport or fly over to the Hartville Kitchen. Some of these are big enough or small enough to where they'll take up a parking spot.
Is it like a drone?
Pardon?
Just bigger than a drone to carry a human?
Think of an old-fashioned telephone box. Okay. With rotors, it just you step in the box, it takes off, and you go somewhere. All right? Or in this case, four people get in, and it takes off and takes you downtown to Cleveland. It'll be a lot faster than ground. They're going to need electrical charging stations.
So what they're going to need parking.
What are your concerns?
That's what this is saying. Like, where will they live?
What are your concerns?
My concerns are, I don't know if we're concerned about this. If the MPOs are only worried about surface transportation, then municipality is going to put up air parks with charging stations, landing areas, and maybe they'll have little autonomous vehicle taxi cabs running around through their town. So you can land at a Cuyahoga Falls City airpark, and electronically you'll be hooked in, and the electronic taxi will roll up, and you tell it where you want it to go. Right. No people involved but you. No pilot, no taxi cab driver. Right. So there'll be an interface with ground transportation with this stuff.
I think the MPOs will keep their pace with the updated technology. So we are following what is in the existence. Right.
Yeah, your traffic pattern.
So whatever comes into existence, we will have a...
Yeah,
we will be ahead of time.
Yeah, traffic patterns I can see changing. Wherever they set up air parks, Cuyahoga Falls has a big area that used to be a school. Boy, that'd be perfect. Put up charging stations, air parks, taxi cabs could roll in and out, and they could go anywhere in northern Summit County.
I think, Curtis, we have started working on some documents with regards autonomous vehicle things like
yeah,
that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, autonomous vehicles, electric charging stations. It's all coming. I mean,
it's all coming, yeah.
The question with stuff like that is just, is that the rich man's game? You know, we can't even get people out of their, you know, gas burning cars. How are we going to jump them to all of a sudden, you know, self-flying helicopter? I mean, it's going to take time. And, you know, there's going to be a, you know, to me, it's like, my God, could we get people in electric vehicles within the next 10 or 15 years?
So I attended an online PAVE meeting, P-A-V-E, capital letters. The chair is Brad Sturtz, head manager, president of Audi of America, Audi Cars. And they're talking about all these electric cars and the problems we're having, the self-driving ones, which really aren't self-driving right now. We've seen some big headlines about cars. Person takes their eyes off the road and they smash
it.
Yeah,
they're not self-driving. Yeah.
That's the wrong word. We have poorly educated drivers. One of which I asked the committee, well, if you're going to buy an electric car with some sort of self-driving assist, will the to avoid lawsuits, will the dealership have to offer and conduct and certify a training classroom and a simulator classroom where you think you're driving a car in a simulator, and then just like you did with your parents or somebody on a road driver, before they release you to drive this vehicle by yourself. Even though you bought it, you got to know all the rules and regulations that go with it, rather than just hand them the keys and say, bye, thanks for the money. That's going to affect us. Green is charged up about the future. This is in the Beacon Journal. And they're talking about their charging stations and what they're putting in. So for the MPO, where's my note? Do we have, should the MPO have, a headcount from each municipality as to type and location of charging stations that could then be made available to the public? Unless Tiger Falls or Green or whatever else, you're driving down through there in your car, you pull over, and then you say, charging stations local, and something will pop up that will direct you to an Acme or a city charging lot or a parking lot with charging lot, something like that.
Yeah, I believe Clean Fuels Ohio already maintains a map of existing charging stations.
Is it available as I drive down the road?
That I don't know.
See.
Might be in an app, right?
But if you're driving a Tesla, Tesla already has
Tesla has
Tesla's
their
already,
built in.
They're already in there.
Yeah.
You're talking about the Google Maps. So if you were in Google, that would show up.
Yeah, I've got an old Garmin, and if I'm somewhere, wherever I'm at, I can punch up restaurants, American or Chinese or barbecue, and it'll pop up, it'll populate locally on my map where I want to go, how far away it is.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, if we're going for electric vehicles, which looks like, some way.
All the electric vehicles are well equipped with those kind of facilities.
Yeah.
If someone would like to search for an electric charging station and driving a gas car, that would be a difficult.
Well, or talk to your little autopilot and say, where's the charging station?
Right.
I mean, I think, it's funny, though, that is an interesting issue, just because we have had those discussions with electric car drivers. It's very real. It's called range anxiety. And so I know a lot of people that have bought electric cars, they have to go through that learning process where they're Googling, making sure they've got charging stations. They're almost almost doing it like a triptych. Back in the day, making sure, okay, I get this far, I know there's a fast charging station.
Yeah.
And I guess it takes a while for them to then, realize that they can rely on the existing system without necessarily having to plan every 200 miles of driving. The challenge right now with the charging stations is that the government really wants to get involved. But the only place the government can do it effectively is areas that are owned by the government. So it's like NOAACA, our sister agency, like they put in a couple $1 million into charging stations, and they're putting them in, parking lot, places that aren't actually going to
have the car.
Yeah, it's like it's not, but because it's like they're like, well, that's better than nothing. But in reality, I mean, this is not meant to be like a political, but you're just like, the way that it has to be put on private, it has to be places where gas stations are. They're the ones that have to embrace this. We can only do so much because it's too expensive for us to buy right away put an electric charging station in right where it needs to
Walmart
be.
Walmart on the Falls Stowe line up there, they've got two out in the parking lot. It makes sense. You're going to go there, you're going to spend a half hour more inside, charge up for half an hour. Right. Parking lot or parking decks, well, I don't know. Why are you going to spend?
I mean, we have one in our parking deck. There's one, is there one in this parking deck, too?
I'm not sure about this one.
But we have one here. There's one in City Center deck. There's one or two. And, that I get, if you're working an eight-hour shift and you pull in and you're like, hey, I want to charge, I get a great parking spot up front and I'll pay, I don't have an issue with that. But to me, it's like when they're putting them in school parking lots and you're going, how many kids are driving electric cars?
Well, how many teachers will be driving?
And how many teachers are driving?
They're going to want to have 20 parking spots to charge their cars while they're teaching.
Right.
So it'll be need-based, but it's somehow you're going to have to get money back out of it, whether it's $5 an hour. Or
yeah. And this is just a personal thing. But, like, I really do believe, like, when electric cars have hit that tipping point, those charging stations will be everywhere. Because hotels, gas stations, when it is monetarily feasible to build those things and make money, we will see them everywhere that we need them.
That's what U.S. is best known for.
Right. It's like the, yeah, like it's the capitalist way. It's like if you think you can make money doing
it. Whatever happened to the idea of a roundabout up where Wyoming Lake Road and North Cuyahoga Falls hits a state road up there? And
is that part of that in the township? Because then the Summit County Engineer happened to that.
Yeah, we raised the idea, but I don't know. I'm not the one to carry the football here, folks.
We fumbled the ball, but we'll pick it back up. No, we talked about it a little bit. Yeah, about that intersection where the state road keeps going. You have a street here, and then you have you're coming out.
Other road, Caesars Road, or something comes across there. Yeah,
county.
Yeah, the county engineer is very opposed to roundabouts. So if the project is in the townships, you're not going to see a roundabout.
But he's a big fan of roundabouts.
Yeah,
look at Paris, France. You want to see a roundabout?
Or Green, you know.
All around the Arc of Triumph. So I see this news article. Montrose is going to take the former Rosemont Country Club and put in commercial and residential developments out there. Four of them. So they're going to do that all by themselves. They don't need to worry about talking to AMATS or anything else.
Nope. Or the EPA, apparently.
I saw they were going to set aside like 60-some acres of the 140-some acres for
Survive. It's private land, and it was zoned residential. So if somebody sells that land to somebody else and they want to build homes on it and the code allows them to.
And all the cars that are added to that area.
They changed the zoning. They didn't change the zoning.
They didn't, but they probably did.
They wanted it for a long way.
Right.
So they
the increase in car traffic is nothing that AMATS has to worry about.
No. I mean, honestly, like, and this is not to disparage, like, the general public in any sort of way, but, like, 60 homes, 100 homes, like, it does not impact traffic the way people assume that it will. Like, you need thousands of homes to really make an impact on your day-to-day travel. Yeah. Now, like, locally, will there be a local stop sign that you wait a little bit longer? Like, possibly, but you got to get well above 60 units for that to be, you know, an incredibly impactful to the area.
That was sort of a discussion that happened on Surf Trail there, on Surf Road, I'm sorry, where they put in all those new houses, and there was a lot of concern that that would raise traffic. But having always driving down Smith Road to get to work, I don't really notice that much more traffic, although there's close to probably a couple hundred homes over there.
Northern State Road in Cuyahoga Falls, they took out a campsite or something and put in housing developments, and hasn't really changed that much up there.
I mean, and it's really interesting. If you look at, you can even go to some of the growing areas like Green and look at, say, an Arlington or a Massillon Road, and you look at the traffic counts from 20 years ago to now, the counts are the same or lower. Like, they're not. Even in places that are growing, people aren't driving the same ways that they were 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, that's one of the things we've had to deal with, even with our engineering community, is just, look, we're not growing at 1% per year traffic. Like, it's not happening. If anything, we're going negative, you know, per year. And even the growth hasn't counteracted that, that decline in traffic.
Have I ever had an AMAT speaker come to one of my club meetings?
Which club? Mensa?
Yeah.
I think Jason went to the Mensa meeting. This was probably a decade ago.
Yeah.
Over a decade ago.
So who's the GOAT? I mean, who's the speaker this year? Sir, if you would do the honor of sending me an email or make to set up a final Friday of a month, in the future, and you get a free meal out of it.
Oh, wait, I'm the speaker now.
Can you elaborate?
No,
what type
no
of
booze, but
is?
You get a meal and a soft drink of water.
I have a long vacation schedule.
Bill, if you need somebody, I can always be there.
Okay. Last question is, how was the coffee?
Very good. I did use it. Thank you. Delicious. Yeah. All
right. Lovely Christmas.
Yes. And the jam, the traffic jam.
Oh, yeah. I'll probably use that up at in your counter area there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just took a spoon.
Well, you'll have to stop and see the new office, though.
I have not made it down to the new office. Yeah. Every time I start to look at Main Street, it's always library and everything. Construction.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to have that done in 2020. Well, 2021, 2022. I don't know when they're going to open up Main Street.
There's just more construction.